And good morning, and welcome to One Land, Many Voices. I'm Will Seaman, and with me is the co-host of One Land, Many Voices, Hala Gores. Good morning, Hala.
Good morning, Will, and good morning to our listeners.
And also with us in the studio, we are, first of all, I need to explain that we're going to be speaking to a couple folks this morning, but with us in the studio is Deborah Rohan, who is the director of the Student Interfaith Peace Project at Joseph Corbell Graduate School of International Studies at the University of Denver. She's also been involved in several projects that bring Arabs and Israelis into dialogue. But most recently, she is author of The Olive Grove, A Palestinian Story. And she's working on a couple of other books. Welcome, Deborah.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, we are also on the line with the author of Overcoming Zionism, a very important book that came out a couple of years ago. Joel Covell, I hope, is on the line with us. Joel, are you there? Not quite yet. So I think what we're going to do is perhaps talk about some of the events, and most important, perhaps, is Deborah's talk tonight at the First Unitarian Church here in Portland. And that's at 7 p.m. this evening, Deborah Rohan, talking about her new book. Tell us just a little bit about that new book, Deborah, while we're waiting to get Joel on the line.
Well, the title of the book is The Olive Grove, A Palestinian Story, and basically, I won't go into it too far, but basically it's the story of Palestinians who are living prior to Zionism. So many books don't talk about what life was like before, how Palestinian people were living there before the influx or the immigration of Jews from Europe and other countries. So we start in 1914 and follow their lives, not in relation to Zionism, but just as life was under Ottoman government, British government, and then, of course, eventually Zionism.
And that is, Deborah will be speaking tonight again at the First Unitarian Church here in Portland. That's at 1011 1011 Southwest 12th in downtown Portland. That again is at 7 p.m.
Deborah, can you tell us a little bit about what brought you to write this book?
Well, you know, as many Americans, I was brought up with the story of the birth of Israel via novels, via Leon Uris and Exodus and stories like that. And I met a Palestinian family in Denver who showed me the other side of the story. So I can tell you more about that.
And we're going to turn to Jess talking about Deborah's new book and the other work that she does at the half-hour point in our show. But right now we do have Joel Covell on the line. Joel, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Let me say just a few words about Joel. He's a scholar and activist. He's been active on social justice issues since the Vietnam War, in anti-war and anti-nuclear movements, in solidarity work in Central America and the Caribbean, for democratic media and ecological transformation. His books include White Racism, nominated for the National Book Award in 1972, Red Hunting in the Promised Land, The Enemy of Nature, The End of Capitalism or the End of the World, but most recently, as we mentioned earlier, Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. Joel Covell, welcome to One Land, Many Voices.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Good morning, Joel. This is Hala Gores. Let's start with your most recent book and the trouble that you had getting it out into the market. Can you tell our listeners about that, please?
Well, part of the trouble was sort of ordinary, suppression, not paying any attention to it, being rejected by many publishers, etc. But what became particularly interesting was after it had been published and was actually doing all right, despite the, cold shoulder, it was attacked by the sort of the Zionist lobbies that suppress these things, and it was forced to be banned briefly. The book is published, still in print, by Pluto Press in England, and had a U.S. distributor, which was the University of Michigan Press. And this is more than a year ago. It was assaulted by various websites under the term Stand With Us Michigan, actually run by a Christian Zionist. But nonetheless, to make a longer story short, the University of Michigan Press panicked and withdrew it from publication, which is really quite remarkable, particularly for an academic press to do something like that. And we got it back eventually, but eventually, further down the line, the Pluto Press's contract with the University of Michigan Press was canceled, basically in order to stifle books of this sort, which are considered outside of the pale of normal debate, you know. And that's the problem, is that we have such a constricted debate in this society. There's so few real options brought forth before the public, and so little real news in depth about what's going on in Israel and Palestine, that you know, we have to fight very vigorously to open up that debate. And that's kind of what the book was originally about, and that's what protecting the book from its suppression has been about.
Well, let's start, if we may, at the beginning. I mean, the title, Overcoming Zionism, I think in some ways takes for granted the idea that Zionism is a well-understood concept, or for that matter, has a single meaning within the broad population that uses it. Could you talk about what you mean by Zionism and maybe a little bit of the history of Zionism?
Sure. Well, I wanted to put the main thesis of the book right in the title so that people would not be misled and not knowing what they're getting. And, you know, they are getting a book that centers its critique of Israel upon the basic logic of Zionism, which I think animates the whole history of Israel and all of its human rights violations. And that is that the idea, which really goes far back in European history, and was originally a Christian idea from England, principally, that Jewish people deserved a state of their own in historic Palestine. And as it became elaborated in the late 19th century, it was the idea that fulfillment of the destiny of the Jewish people, that the Jewish people can only solve the problem, the Jewish question, as they called itself, or the, you know, question of anti-Semitism, and by leaving Europe and founding a nation state in Palestine, which was not to be an ordinary nation state, but one of, for, and by Jewish people. In other words, an ethnically centered state. And that's been the constant ground plan. There are variants of Zionism, but the one that has historical traction is political Zionism, which emphasizes that there must be a state which is a Jewish state. And that's the argument that I make in the book, that that's a very bad idea. It was a big mistake in the beginning, and it's a mistake that has, you know, led to enormous suffering, and I think has really been not good for the Jewish people themselves, to sponsor endeavor of that sort, because the basic problem has always been that there are other people living there. The Zionists sent some emissaries to Palestine in the late 1890s, and they cabled back to the Zionist headquarters. They said, the quote, this is an actual quote, the cable said, quote, "The bride is beautiful, but she is married to another man," you know, the bride being Palestine, the other man being the Palestinians who were living there and had a difficult time of it because they were subjects of the Ottoman Empire. They didn't have their own government, but there were plenty of them there. And so the whole project of Zionism meant not just building a state, but clearing the land for that state. And the long and complex centuries, over a century-long history, has been one of ethnic cleansing. Before that word, that term was even coined, I mean, the Zionists entered upon that project. And you can't do that and maintain human rights. You can't do that and build a true democracy. You can't do that and live up to the dignity of your own traditions, which, you know, has always been to fight injustice. And so this led the Jewish people into this terrible moral quandary and highly contradictory situation. And my book explores that. It defines the term. It gives its history, psychology, you know, the politics and all those other things, and basically concludes that it's an idea that we should all get over, that's hence overcoming Zionism, that we can get over. It's very hard, but lots of people are getting over it, and lots of Jewish people are getting over it. That's the important thing. A lot of Jewish people around the world, not just the United States, saying that the Zionism was a really wrong turn, and we have to move in another direction.
Joel, one of my friends has said to me that as a Jew, she can't seem to get over that fear of not having a place to run to if someplace in the world we are to relive another Holocaust. How do you deal with that?
Well, fears are very real, but they don't have to be rational. And if they're not rational, you have to work on them. First of all, Jews have done extremely well in this country itself. You know, there's never been a serious anti-Semitic. I mean, there have been some minor anti-Semitic aspects to life in this country, but there's a very long history now of Jews in the United States, which is one of enormous success and acceptance, and indeed a great deal of power in very large parts of society. And yet it is definitely true that fear persists, and that fear is, of course, generated by the horrors of the Holocaust, and it's also generated by the peculiar spiritual dilemma of living in the United States, where you gain the world, but sometimes you feel you lose your soul because the history of Jews. Now, I'm not talking about Jews all over the world, but the history of European Jews, and especially Ashkenazi Jews from Central and Eastern Europe. This history is one of exclusion, marginalization, and feeling that you're the other, you know, that you don't really belong. And so when you get into a society and you realize you can belong, it's often very hard, and it's accompanied by significant feelings of doubt, because what happens now to the spiritual center of that religion? And there's some very good studies about it, and I would urge this person you mentioned to engage in those studies. You might want to read, for instance, Peter Novick's book. Novick is not an anti-Zionist. He's just a historian from the University of Chicago, a very good historian, wrote a book called The Holocaust in American Life, which has detailed how those attitudes have persisted in the Jewish consciousness, but have been extensively, and this is important, been extensively manipulated. They're not like attitudes that sort of spring automatically from the center of Jewish life. They've been played upon by powerful interests who see the state of Israel as the necessary be-all and end-all of the Jewish Jewish existence, and it's very important to get that history down, because I think a rational person will conclude, wait, there's got to be a better way of doing this. First of all, the terrible events of the Holocaust in no sense justify taking another people's land for your purposes. There's no moral ground for that, and that, of course, just adds a layer of moral contradiction to the finding of secure, Jewish existence. In fact, it can never be a secure Jewish existence, because it's built upon, frankly, ethnic cleansing, which is to say robbery. Fear and loathing of the people from whom you've stolen that land, and so on and so forth. So the Jewish life is very complex. It's full of many sides, but I think that it can be, it can be moved in a much better direction. There is no evidence at all that any kind of second Holocaust is likely to occur. It can't by any conceivable means occur in the Middle East. The Arabs got furious and enraged by Zionism, and they said all kinds of, crazy things, but there's no way they could ever back them up. And it's just not a real instance. It's a fear that has to be endlessly manipulated and conjured up in order to secure the power and legitimacy of the State of Israel. And that's not a good way to live.
Joel, this is Deborah Rowan, and I wanted to ask a question about your book, if I could.
Sure.
When you talk about Zionism, do you think that it means, and it has meant from the beginning, that Arab people there have to leave? In other words, would you have supported Zionism when you talk about the early immigrants coming from Russia and Eastern Europe, that they were running from something, in the late 1800s, they were running from oppression and pogroms. And so had they come and had they wanted to share the land, would that still by definition be Zionism, and would support that?
My view, it wouldn't be Zionism.
Right, so it would...
A lot of them ran to the United States, you know, like my own grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not immediately. But there were pogroms that had taken place in both of the towns in Ukraine where my grandmother and grandfather were born. Where my mother and father were born, but they were little kids when they left Russia for the U.S., and that was one reason why they left. I mean, my father's father left to escape the draft, which is kind of related to that, because Jews had to go in for 20 years, a horrible life they had, and nobody denies that, but they came to the U.S., and they built a very fine life for themselves, and, you know, complicated, like all lives are complicated, but, you know, nobody ever trampled on their rights. So they could have done that, or they could have joined social movements to try to eliminate the basis of anti-Semitism, which is not something that is in the genes. It's a product of social circumstances that can be overcome themselves, and a lot of Jews worked on that. You know, Jews took part in just about every major left-wing movement of the 20th century, from Bolshevism to, you know, various labor movements here in this country and elsewhere. And all of those things could have been done. And in particular, if they want to go to Palestine, they could have gone to Palestine and did go to Palestine and form their own communities. The indigenous Arab peoples didn't have very much say in it because, you know, they didn't own the land to speak of. It was owned by the Ottoman Turks. You could have, you know, purchased certain lands and built a little communities there, and some of that was done. If you wanted to worship, there was a Zionist called Acharaham, who Asher Ginsberg his name was, he felt that the Zionism that emerged in Israel was before Israel, but, you know, was being built there was all wrong, because it should have been a spiritual movement where Jews went to form religious communities, and they could have done that. There was never any opposition to that. The opposition arose once the indigenous people realized, and it was pretty obvious after a very short time, that these people who came were settlers who were also colonialists and wanted to destroy their life, their way of life, destroy their economy, destroy their culture, just as it finally did happen in the in 1948 and in the aftermath of 1948.
So is the problem with Zionism that at its core it is exclusive? It is intended as the creation of the state for the Jews only. So we could have had a different history, you say, had Zionism been about providing a safe homeland for Jews, but to share the land with Palestinians? Is that what you're saying?
Most definitely, sure. I mean, that was on the board. You have to go into the particular history of the founding of the State of Israel and all the, you know, it's very complex, so we couldn't do it in a few minutes here on the air, but there's no question that I would agree with that. The partition agreement that the UN imposed in 1947 said that there had to be two separate entities, but the Arabs rejected it because they said they wanted to share the land. They didn't want their own state. They wanted to share. They wanted everybody to try to work it out. The Zionist settlers, of course, rejected it because they felt they had to have a state in order to have the power to expel the remaining Palestinians. And if you think that's a curious attitude, you should read some of the recent histories. The best one is by Ilan Pape, P-A-P-P-E, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. The book was published he was a historian from Haifa, now in England. He was driven out of the country, basically, but the book was published last year. And it's a very clear, accurate history, which predictably has been ignored in the United States. It has no role here in our intellectual discourse, although it's very widely respected around the world. And he just shows very clearly how Ben-Gurion, the sort of George Washington figure of Israel, who said, we have to have our state. We'll take it on part of the land because the state gives us the power to exert, you know, force, and violent force if necessary, to expand its boundaries. And, of course, that's exactly what's happened and continues to happen. Every day it happens.
For our listeners, we should let you know that we have interviewed Ilan Pappé. And can you tell our listeners where they can go to listen to that interview?
That's right. All of the past shows of One Land, Many Voices are available at www.pdxjustice.org. And you can also find our past shows on the KBOO website at www.kboo.fm. Joel, I'd like to maybe focus down a little bit the scope of our discussion here and look specifically at the American community and the American Jewish community, but I think also more broadly conceptions of Israel and Zionism here in the United States. And what I'm trying to get at is I grew up here in a secular Jewish household. Actually, my father isn't Jewish. My mother is Jewish. And I don't think I ever heard the word Zionism, but I definitely absorbed the general feeling that it was good to have a state for the Jews. But I think I also had an extremely false picture of what that meant, what that actually translated to,
right,
in terms of the institutions of that country, in terms of land ownership, in terms of, in other words, the levels of discrimination and the dispossession that took place to create that state.
Right.
And I actually had to travel to Israel, and it was my family there that sort of sat me down and said, you know, Will, it's a little more complicated than you think.
Yeah.
So what I'm getting at is Zionism, I think, has a mythological kind of definition in this country. That's a little tricky to say that because people believe whatever they believe. But I think many people who would self-identify as Zionists are both unaware of the discrimination that it is meant in terms of the state of Israel within the state of Israel. Many of them are ignorant of the oppression, of the character and the reasons for the occupation and the dispossession in 1948. I think, you know, that what we have it, especially in the United States, is this history of misinformation about what Zionism has meant. How, that's certainly got to be a part of overcoming Zionism. How do you confront that aspect of the understanding of Zionism here?
Well, I don't have any magic, you know, remedy, but I, you know, in a year and a half since the book has been out, I've spoken maybe 100 times or more. You know, I just keep at it. I do things like this. You have listeners, hopefully, who say, maybe the guy has a point. Let's read more. Let's think a little bit about it. I mean, it's a very slow, patient, not very spectacular effort. I mean, you have to realize that the Zionist forces in this country are extraordinarily powerful. That's a whole other issue I can get into, but, you know, let's face it, they control the U.S. government in a lot of ways. I don't mean in a conspiratorial way, but when you have, you know, Barack Obama sort of going to APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee conventions, after he gets the Democratic nomination, and basically saying, I'll do anything you say, I bow down before you, I mean, that's amazing, and you know, we can go into the detail of that. There's enormous power of I call the Zionist apparatus, others have called the Zionist power structure, whatever. It's very real. And it's not a Jewish conspiracy. It's not a conspiracy at all. It's a very complex set of institutions that are consciously directed by a minority of Jewish people who happen to be Zionists and get other Jewish people to line up behind them because they can be made fearful, as we talked about earlier. So, but it's just it's a slow and steady process. What the Zionists do not control is really civil society, the base of U.S. society. I mean, of course, there's very deep, widespread control among synagogues, and it's often very hard to reach people in synagogues. But even that has to be done. It's just something that the slow, steady application of truth-telling has a really powerful effect. The thing is that everybody who works in this, there's quite a bit of us, I feel that the tide is turning, that we're actually making a difference. The Zionist powers are still extremely strong, but to repeat, they are only a minority, even of Jews. The older Jewish people are very much tied into it, because in part because, you know, they relate more to the, you know, the older history of, and the Holocaust experience, which, as I said, is falsely applied, but nonetheless powerfully applied to Israel. And younger Jewish people are increasingly willing to look around. I mean, you know, I'm teaching a course at the school where I teach. I'm not in favor with the school administration, the heavily Zionist, but they have to let me teach this course. And, you know, the youngsters are, you know, getting a different look, and their lives are being, I think, you know, opened up by this. By this look, so it's something that I think it's a battle that is that can be won. It's a battle of ideas, and the fact of the matter is that the state of Israel rests upon certain myths, like 1948, or certain falsifications of history, and you know, a whole mythological structure which just has to be deconstructed. A lot of that's been deconstructed in Israel itself. I mean, this tremendous scholarship coming out of Israel about the Bible, for instance, which is this book called The Bible Unearthed by two archaeologists, Finkelstein and Silverman. Couldn't get more Jewish than that. They're not at all anti-Zionist. They're just, you know, Jews who want to correct the record. And they say, you know, gee, all that biblical history does not grant us what thought we were granted. You know, it's just, there was no exodus from Egypt, for instance. It was, all of that was, you know, reconstructed centuries later, and we can go into that if you like. But it's,
Joel, we're going to have to.
There's no expulsion from Palestine by the Romans.
All right, we're coming up on the half hour, and I want to give you at least a brief amount of time here at the end to talk about the second part of your title, which is creating a single democratic state in Israel Palestine. Could you just talk briefly about that? Yeah, we know we're going to have to have you on again sometime in the future.
Well, I'd always love to do that. Yes, I think that's the key thing. That what's happened is that after about a 20-year period, the idea of a so-called peace process and the two-state solution resulting out of that is coming apart, thanks to settlements in the territories and a number of other things. And the original idea, which is that maybe the land can be shared, is being revived. It's a long, difficult process, but even just in the few years since I've been very active in this, you can see a big shift going on. For instance, just recently, just today, as a matter of fact, in England, there's an official launching of something called IJAN, International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, you can look that up on the web. And what that means is that there's now Jews who are saying, listen, Zionism is the big problem. These are people from India, from Canada, from Israel, too. I mean, and all over Europe and in the United States. And the point is, if it's an anti-Zionist network, then you can't have a Jewish state. And if you're serious about Zionism, you mean the Palestinians have to have the right to return to the land from which they've been expelled. When that happens, there's then going to be a demographic shift. It'll be the majority. And if that happens, then you have to restructure and reconfigure the state. And it'll take a form of the struggle in South Africa against, you know, systematic racism that they have. And it's really hard, and it's not, there's no glib answers to it, but it's something that's in the air, and people are starting to discuss. And as they're discussing it, they're going to build that path by walking, you know, by working in that direction. There's no question that that's now becoming on the world agenda, and I think it's going to be fulfilled.
Joel, for many years I've been in support of a single democratic state for both people, a secular democratic state for both people. But I have been criticized, as many one-staters are now, that we are really talking about a utopia, that it sounds good on paper, but that in reality there is no way you're going to get both of these people to live together peacefully. And I'll draw your attention to a poll that was done recently in Israel, where something like 70% or more of Israeli Jews questioned, responded that there is no way they would live with a Palestinian in the same condo community or in the same apartment community. How do you deal with that?
Well, you know, And undoubtedly, if you polled people in the antebellum South in the United States in 1855, they would have said the same. I hope, and I don't think we need a violent civil war, but these, you know, history has a way of moving on, you know. People used to say, oh, we're never going to get rid of slavery, you know, or we're never going to give women the right to vote, you know, they're, you know, inferior, et cetera, et cetera. There are all kinds of obstacles to a better world that simply have to be confronted with an open mind and with respect for the capacity of human beings to transform their lives. This is not a utopian plan, because utopia means nowheres. It's not nowheres. It's very located. It's very practical. It's what I would call not a utopia, but a strategic goal, one state. In other words, you say, well, listen, we have to think in terms of undoing the Zionist, you know, logic of things. And when that happens, which will take a while and it's not going to be easy, people will, you know, will begin to redefine, and reconfigure their political life accordingly. It's a strategic goal, meaning that it sets out the kinds of political paths that you enter. You know, yes, we want a one state. I don't know what a one state will look like. I just know that it needn't be Zionist. We needn't have a Jewish state.
Joel.
Professor Covell, thank you so much for joining us on One Land, Many Voices. We definitely will have to have you back.
All right. Well, I'm available, and it's a pleasure talking to you.
You too, and thank you for talking to us about overcoming Zionism, creating a single democratic state in Israel-Palestine.
And you're tuned to One Land, Many Voices, and you're listening to KABU, listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge, and naturally also available as streaming audio at KABU's website at www.kboo.fm. And I think we were going to do a musical break, but I think we're going to go straight to our second guest, who has been patiently waiting in the studio, listening to a very interesting discussion with Joel Colville, but nonetheless being very patient. Let's talk about literature, and in particular this recent book that you've written. We got into it a little bit at the top of the hour, but tell us a little bit about this book and maybe its interesting history in terms of publishing.
Well, I think it's interesting that I am on the same program with Joel and the topic of this book, Overcoming Zionism and Living in One State Together. I'm sorry, I can't say the exact title of the book from here, but because the book that I wrote really speaks to the very same topic, because during the starting in 1914, which is when my book begins, there were Jews, Muslims, and Christians living side by side in the same neighborhoods in a land that was then called Palestine. So really, what Joel's referring to in his book is a return, albeit with very different numbers and a different situation in the world. It's really the same thing, and I think that's where most of the world would feel very comfortable if we could return to less divisive with borders and so forth in Israel and put it back into one country. But so my book, though, actually does begin during the Ottoman Empire in 1914, and it was quite a peaceful time, and people were poor, and World War I was just about was beginning. But it was a time when there was a lot of cohesiveness in the world. In fact, the main characters in my book, their next door neighbor, they're Palestinian, they're a Muslim, and their next door neighbor is a rabbi, and there's a very strong friendship throughout the whole book, and how it portrays really how they go through the whole 40-50 year period together and how it looks to both of them, although it's primarily through the eyes of a Palestinian story, a Palestinian family.
You know, I think it's wonderful that your book breaks that myth that Jews and Arabs have been fighting for thousands of years and they will never get along.
Yeah.
Because your book is basically one example of my own family's history going back for centuries in Palestine of Jews, Muslims, and Christians living together.
You know, it's I'm happy to hear that you can also attest to that. I remember Hamzi, who was the man who told me mostly about their family, although all the brothers and sisters in his family and the mother, they all contributed. But he would talk about how they were a Muslim family, but they would color the Easter eggs for the Christians and, you know, talked about all the different colors. He went into great detail with the daffodils and the beets and all the things they would use to naturally color them. And during Ramadan, how the Jews and the Christians would help them. And also there's scenes in the book where, of course, in Shabbat, they're helping the rabbi turn off the lights or go do something where they can't touch money. They'll do it for him. So it's the basis of it. So it's not utopia. It seems utopian now, but obviously it was a very real situation.
What research did you do as you got ready to write this book?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I did grow up with a very strong, and I continue to have a very strong belief in a safe place for Jewish people, and I grew up with Exodus, and I was very influenced by the fact that I read, and this is why I put this into a novel, because I wanted the emotion. I wanted to have the see it through the eyes and through the hearts and through everything of the people who actually lived at the time, rather than having a little bit more distance through a historical recollection. So, as far as research, though, I when I met Hamzi, I was very reticent to accept his story because it really competed with everything I had grown up with. When I met him, I was afraid of him. This is in 1993. He was a Palestinian, and I did not have very good. I didn't know really what a Palestinian was. I thought they were just Arabs there. I'd never heard the term Palestinian in relation to, in any of those books that talk about the birth of Israel. So I first had to fully understand what it meant to be a Palestinian. I traveled there. I traveled and went to his former home, which is now a synagogue. I went to Lebanon and interviewed his family, his mother and his brothers and sisters, and to Jordan and in the United States and in Colorado primarily. There were a lot of family members. They were here because of the Lebanese Civil War. That's where they had become refugees, and they were in Denver sort of taking refuge from that.
So his family had originally become refugees in 1948?
Yes. They were a very wealthy landowning family, very well respected in the community. And as you'll see if you read the book, or many people know already, they left for a couple weeks to take safety and were never able to get the money from their bank or any of their lands back. So it was, you know, it's a tearjerker, as the whole story is, but you follow them from the building up of their lands in the 1914 and all through as they buy more land and they work with the sharecroppers and until the point which they do leave and shortly thereafter. But I just wanted to finish about the history. I did all the historical research on my own. At the time I didn't trust him, and I feel very bad saying that, but I wanted to know that what he was telling me was historically accurate. So as far as all the real-life historical situations in the book, they're from my own personal research, and all the family are from their stories, from their family stories. But they always coincided, and I was very sheepish after I realized that I was being a little tougher. He said I was their toughest critic ever.
Well, I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about that historical research. Were there particular works, histories, that you came across that stand out as being important? Because we want to encourage our listeners not only to tune in to this program, you know, 1 hour every month, but also to begin to engage with this. And there are some really spectacular histories that have been written over the last 20 years.
Well, there weren't very many in the United States. I actually started researching this book in 1993. I think I first started traveling over there in 1994. And at that time, I felt like there was more information coming from even Jewish historians that were more accurate than what I could get in the United States, Benny Morris, people like that. But also the British had a number of they're not well known, and I'm going to be in a bind here to rattle off the names. I'd be happy to provide them. I have a full list at home. But personal accounts by British soldiers who were there who could say, this is what I saw when I went into Palestinian home. This is what we were asked to do. I looked at a British police blotter, which was probably one of the most interesting accounts of the period, because it did speak to Jewish terrorism, which we don't hear much about, the Stern Gang and the blowing up of the King David Hotel. There was a lot, but those were the major ones, but there were a lot of minor incidents that you don't read in books, but you see them on the police blotters, how Palestinians were really persecuted, I guess is the word, you know, as were the British soldiers. And there were a lot of events that I was able to get information from reading that police blotter over several years. There's an encyclopedia, actually, that covers all of that. So that was a little eye-opening because you couldn't really misinterpret it.
I know that when I'm writing, and I don't write fiction, but when I'm writing, the process of writing is, in fact, a process of coming to a better understanding and even a kind of a discovery. Mm-hmm. As you were writing this book, were there cases of that kind of experience where you felt that having crafted this book, you gained a new insight yourself in terms of this experience?
Every minute of every hour that I worked on this book, that happened. It was just one thing would fall off after another. Every preconceived notion I had or misinformation I had, I was shocked continually. Starting with the fact that there was a lively Palestinian community there. I mean, I feel embarrassed now when I think about what my impression was at the time. You know, you say, because all these quotes, you know, let them fold their tents and steal away into the night because this is how they live. I mean, this is what some of the early Zionists were saying. And then I would look at photos of their family where they have this nice big stone house and they're wearing suits and ties and their women are not covered. They look like American women in the 1940s. His sisters were actually politically active in the 40s. So many misconceptions. And their family in particular, education was primary, and they had a very, very strict regimen of what they had to do every evening. And the whole community, how it worked together and how the Jews and the Muslims and the Christians interacted. And they had social schedules every night. The so-and-so Kanafanis came on Tuesday evenings to visit. And, you know, just this very rich, beautiful community, which we never, ever hear about.
Have you faced any backlash whatsoever in presenting your book in America?
It was difficult to get. I did not get the book published in the United States, and it did take me a number of years. I initially self-published the book, and then it was finally picked up by Saki Books in London. Now, whether that was because the story wasn't told, I mean, I can't say that, But as far as a backlash, you know, because I don't have anti-Semitic feelings in me, I was very sympathetic to Jewish people and continue to be today, even in Israel. I tend to walk a very balanced line. And my book just naturally evolved out of that position. I had empathy for the Jews. I had empathy for the Palestinians, be they Muslim or Christian. And I think that comes out in the book. When people read it, they don't feel that I'm against anyone, that I'm just trying to tell a story of what happened to one family in the context of that time. And as a result, in fact, just the opposite happened. I was hired, the original book came out on 9/11, 2001. I was hired by the Institute for the Study of Israel in the Middle East at the University of Denver by an Israeli, the Israeli director of that organization, because he read the book and he related to it. And he said, he was a commander in the Israeli army in IDF. And he said, I really do not know my own history. I do not know, you know, not that he's not very pro-Israel. He is, but he didn't know. And so he actually hired me to reach out to the Muslim and Arab Palestinian community in Denver to bring them into dialogue in this organization. So I would almost say I had the opposite. But, you know, to get a Jewish person in the United States to pick this up and read it is a challenge. Once they do, there's no backlash.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I've been fortunate.
You've hit upon something about the teaching, listening, and dialogue skills to victims of conflict. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's actually through the same organization at the University of Denver that we decided that in Denver and in the United States, in the world, actually, There's a huge division between religions that continues to grow, and as we see the growth of fundamentalism in all the religions, we see them separating rather than pulling together, again, as they did in this time that I write about in the book. So we did start an organization in Denver, in the University of Denver, called the Student Interfaith Peace Project. And although we're at a university, it's directed towards high school students, and we bring Muslim, Jewish, and Christian kids together, although this year we have interest now from atheists, we have interest from Buddhists, and so, of course, we're accepting them as well because that only makes it a richer dialogue. And we study for a full year. We study listening skills, or teach them, I should say, but I also obviously learn from it, listening, dialogue skills, leadership. But they sit down and they learn about one another's religion. So we eat dinner together and we look at the things that naturally come up with dietary restrictions, or sometimes Muslim students, if it's during Ramadan, they're fasting, or we wait for the, you know, sunset so they can eat, we can all eat together. So we still have natural, understanding and learning that comes up just by being in the same room together. And then last year we took them to Israel and the West Bank and met with a mix of students there to talk. And we talk about Israel and we talk about Zionism, we talk about what's going on. But when you walk into a refugee camp and you see it, or you walk into a settler's home and you talk to them, it all takes on obviously a much stronger resonance, and you feel it in your heart. And people who were actually quite, some of the Jewish students really did not want to go to the West Bank, even though they had agreed to go beforehand. They were afraid, and I understood that they were afraid, and they tried to back out. And I said, you know, you agreed to this a very long time ago, and I know you're afraid, but we're going to go. And they're the ones who actually came out and said, oh my goodness, you know, I really didn't know. And the whole trip, it just opened everyone's eyes. It's been a very powerful organization.
And we're speaking with Deborah Rohan. Her book is The Olive Grove, A Palestinian Story. She is speaking tonight at the First Unitarian Church here in Portland at 7 p.m., and that's at 1011 Southwest 12th in downtown Portland, the First Unitarian Church at 7 p.m. for our guest, Deborah Rohan. I also want to mention a couple other events here. There's a little competition, but there's a solution to this competition. Tonight also, you can see the film Jerusalem, East Side Story. This is a U.S. premiere. This screening will be followed by a conversation with the director, Mohammed Al-Attar. And that's happening also, sadly, tonight, conflicting with our author's talk, at 7 p.m. in Lake Oswego at the Christ Church Episcopal. However, you have another opportunity to see that film, and that's on Saturday, October 25th at 7 p.m. in Vancouver at the First Congregational United Church of Christ. And I think also, yes, Sunday, November 2nd. This is a different event. No, Sunday, November 2nd from 9 to 10 a.m. at the Central Lutheran Church, the Free Gaza Boat Lift Report and the Israel-Palestine Political Update with eyewitness human rights lawyer Tom Nelson. That's Sunday, November 2nd. But let's return to our conversation, or is there another event that we need
actually,
to talk about?
No, I actually was just going to tell our listeners that Tom Nelson is a local attorney, and it will be quite interesting to go and listen to him on November 2nd. But let's get back to Deborah Rohan and find out a little bit more. I understand you're currently working on two new books. Can you tell us about those?
I'm on the spot here. Well, I think I mentioned earlier that, I mean, in my view, the only way to come to any kind of resolution, and I know we're looking down the road a little ways to a resolution in between Israelis and Palestinians, but one way to get there is to understand the history better of both peoples. A situation that I've been hearing over the last few years from Jews, when they talk about Jews in the United States and also Israelis, when we're talking about the final status negotiations, we're talking about the right of return, you know, assuming there's a two-state solution versus the one state we were referring to earlier. There is so much argument and so many hard feelings over whether Palestinians should return to Israel proper, and of course Israelis are fully against that in large measure. They often bring up the topic of their own refugee history as Jews in Arab states left after the creation of Israel. They had to leave, whether it was Yemen or Iraq or Morocco or Ethiopia or a number of Arab countries. And they will bring up the fact that there's about 750,000 Arabs who had to leave, which is about the same number who had to leave their countries and go to Israel, which is about the same number of Palestinians who left the new state of Israel and became refugees. So this conversation comes up so frequently that I thought I would do some research on that. And I know a number of Jews who left Arab states and went to Israel, and their families left. So I'm following the story of one family. It's a novel as well. It's called The Soul Divided, and it talks about an Israeli or a Baghdad Jewish family, Baghdadi, if that's the word, who left, and they left in 1952 in an airlift and went to Israel. And the challenges that they faced, they did not want to go. They were not Zionists, and they did not want to go there, but both because Zionists wanted them to come there, and also because life became untenable in Iraq, they wound up going. And so it's a story of their difficulty of being coming from an Arab culture, speaking Arabic, even though you're Jewish, and they had Arabic food, Arabic instruments, everything in their life was Arab. And then they're now in the state of Israel and rejected because of their Arab history, even though they're Jewish. So it's very complex, and hence A Soul Divided is the title of the book. And the other book, I'll just say briefly, I've been working on this one for quite a while, but it's a story about, this is a nonfiction book, the one I'm about to tell you about, and it's basically, I'm just talking about how women have become the peacemakers, have been starting to take the role as peacemakers in the world in a number of countries. If we look around in Africa, especially, there's a huge movement of women finding, physically putting themselves between warring tribes and taking the role, saying we don't want war anymore. And so I'm just following a history of women around the world who are working and coming out very strongly as peacemakers, as indigenous grandmothers. It covers a lot of different people.
Sounds fascinating. I'll definitely be looking forward to reading both of these books. So what's the plan for you in terms of taking your book? Are you going around the country? Or?
Well, this is not a huge publishing house. This is an independent house. And I spoke in L.A. last week and in Seattle the other night, and tonight in Portland and in Washington, D.C. in November. And that about wraps it up. And also I started in Denver, The Tattered Cover. And I've spoken in Denver for years about this book at book clubs and a number of different, people are very curious. There's a hunger out there for this information. The tide is turning, and people are willing to listen to it now, especially I think when it's presented in a way that is gentle and doesn't hit you over the head, because it doesn't take us anywhere. So just say, just read it. Just see what happened to someone else. You don't have to defend your position, and just let it in a little bit. And so I think once it's used in schools, universities in Denver, hopefully it will, that will happen around the country as well. But that's about the extent of the book tour at this point.
That's wonderful. When was the last time you were back in Israel, Palestine?
I was there in June, just when I took the students there. We took 16 students, and I'll probably be returning there again in next summer with a number of students as well. Mm-hmm. We're trying to build a network of students between the United States and the Middle East that are interested in peacemaking and interested in interreligious dialogue. And that's really the goal of the program.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me that there is this fear of the other that you describe at the high school level, the Jewish kids not wanting to go to the West Bank. Was there also that same fear with Muslim kids going to Israel?
Well, there wasn't really. I wouldn't say there's a fear of the other. That isn't why they were afraid to go there. They have been, the reason why I think you'd mentioned earlier in a poll, 70% of Israelis said they wouldn't want to live or go to school,
live with.
That did not used to be the case. Even in 1967, that was not the case. I mean, Israelis tell me they love the Arab culture. They're very related peoples, So the wall that's been built has really done such a disservice, and all the fighting, of course, the last few years has created something where they think that they're taught now to be afraid of the other side, and they're taught to be afraid of the other. But the Jewish kids that we took, they weren't afraid of Palestinians or Arabs because we'd been with them in class and we'd been with them in Galilee and in the Negev. It was more that they were saying, going to that side, we can't protect you there. There's no Israeli protection. You're on your own. You're in kind of no man's land. There's a huge fear that instilled in them. They weren't afraid of other people. They were just afraid of what will happen to me when I'm not protected. I'm in the West Bank. Of course, they had a wonderful experience. They were, they're fed and catered to and spoken to with respect. And that's And people were speaking only of peace, and that was the number one thing. If you go on our website, in fact, maybe share that? The website for our it's called the Student Interfaith Peace Project, and it's www.sipproject.org. So it's SIP Project, SIP. Two P's. It's not an easy time.
SIPproject.org.
Right, with two P's. No, I lost my train of thought. That took me completely off.
That's okay. Just in terms of the fear, was whether there was any concern about going to Israel. You know, I was born in Nazareth and left with my family as a 10-year-old, and I have not been back.
Yeah.
My parents go back every couple, 3 years, but I have not been back. So there's a lot of fear and anxiety about returning.
There's a lot of general fear in this country. When people, you say you're even going to the Middle East, they don't even wait to hear where. There's just an immediate knee-jerk reaction. I think that the Muslims did not show fear in going to Israel, which I thought was interesting. Some of them were Ethiopian, some of them were American, one was Lebanese. However, they did have trouble in the airport, and that started things off to a very bad, on a very bad note. The Muslims were one of the students who is Hispanic was also pulled off because I guess he looked like a Muslim. So they were questioned at length, you know, in the airport, and that was a rude awakening for everyone, and we kind of had to really work on that to get back on the same page because it was hurt feelings from the get-go. But the fear, no, I think they were not afraid.
We've been speaking with author Deborah Rohan. Her book is The Olive Grove, A Palestinian Story. She's speaking tonight at the First Unitarian Church of Portland at 1011 Southwest 12th. That's at 7 p.m. tonight. If you have questions, you can get into a much more extended conversation with our guest this morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed being here.
And if you, as we mentioned earlier, if you've missed any of our previous programs, or if you just want to listen again to one of our past guests, all of our programs are available on demand, streaming audio at www.pdxjustice.org. And of course, you'll also find them on the KBOO website at www.kboo.org. If you want to write to us, at One Land Many Voices, please send us an email at pdxjustice@riseup.net. Our theme music, which you're about to hear, is provided by the wonderful musician Rahim Al-Haj. We open usually with Dance of the Palms, and our closing music is Yearning, both from the album Iraqi Music in a Time of War. Thank you for tuning in. Thanks for supporting KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio.